cycle is in its expansion phase, the statistics on new issuance make clear that investors are buying new issues in greater amounts. But the acceptance of securities of lower quality is a bit more subtle. While there are credit ratings and covenants to look at, it can take effort and inference to understand the significance of these things. In feeding frenzies caused by excess availability of funds, recognizing and resisting this trend seems to be beyond the ability of the majority of market participants. This is one of the many reasons why the aftermath of an overly generous capital market includes losses, economic contraction, and a subsequent unwillingness to lend. The bottom line of all of the above is that generous credit markets usually are associated with elevated asset prices and subsequent losses, while credit crunches produce bargain basement prices and great profit opportunities, open and shut. The ultimate purpose of this book isn't to help you understand cycles after they've taken place, like the global financial crisis, as described at such great length. Rather, it is to enable you to sense where we stand in the various cycles in real time, and thus to take the appropriate action. The key to dealing with the credit cycle lies in recognizing that it reaches its apex when things have been going well for a while, news has been good, risk aversion is low, and investors are eager. That makes it easy for borrowers to raise money and causes buyers and investors to compete for the opportunity to provide it. The result is cheap financing, low credit standards, weak deals, and the unwise extension of credit. Borrowers hold the cards when the credit window is wide open, not lenders or investors. The implications of all of this should be obvious. Proceed with caution. The exact opposite becomes true at the other extreme of the credit cycle. Its nadir is reached when developments are unpleasant, risk aversion is heightened, and investors are depressed. Under such circumstances, no one wants to provide capital, the credit market freezes up, and proposed offerings go begging. This puts the cards into the hands of providers of capital rather than the borrowers. Because borrowing is difficult and capital is generally unavailable, those who possess it and are willing to part with it can apply rigorous standards, insist on strong loan structures and protective covenants, and demand high prospective returns. It's things like these that provide the margin of safety required for superior investing. When these boxes can be ticked, investors should swing into an aggressive mode. Superior investing doesn't come from buying high-quality assets, but from buying when the deal is good, the price is low, the potential return is substantial, and the risk is limited. These conditions are much more the case when the credit markets are in the less euphoric, more stringent part of their cycle. The slammed-shut phase of the credit cycle probably does more to make bargains available than any other single factor. Chapter 10. The Distressed Debt Cycle. Few lenders and bond buyers are imprudent enough to advance money that won't be repaid if conditions remain as they are. And in sober times, they insist on a margin of safety sufficient to ensure that interest and principal will be paid, even if conditions for the debtor deteriorate. But when the credit market heats up, when the race to the bottom causes avid lenders to finance less deserving borrowers and accept weaker debt structures, bonds are issued that lack that margin of safety and won't be able to be serviced if things get a little worse. This is the unwise extension of credit. This process, as we say at Oak Tree, stacks the logs in the fireplace for the next bonfire. I was fortunate to partner with Bruce Karsh 3 decades ago, and together in 1988 we formed our first fund for distressed debt investing, which we believe was one of the very first from a mainstream financial institution. That took us into a highly specialized investment niche. Rather than companies that are doing well or have bright futures, our distressed debt investments are generally in companies that are doing so poorly that they've defaulted on their outstanding debt or are considered highly likely to do so. They're either in bankruptcy or viewed as heading for it. To be clear, our typical company isn't challenged operationally. just overloaded with debt. Thus, our mantra is, good company, bad balance sheet. Normally, investors buy debt securities or make loans because they expect to be paid interest periodically and have their principal repaid when the debt matures. With distressed debt, however, the consensus is that these things won't occur. Instead, it is expected that the debt won't stay current or be serviced. So if interest and principal aren't expected to be paid, what is the distressed debt investor's motivation? The answer is that debt holders who aren't paid as scheduled have a creditor claim against the debtor. In short, and to oversimplify, when a company goes through bankruptcy, the old owners are wiped out, and the old creditors become the new owners. Each creditor receives his share of the value of the company, depending on the amount and seniority of the debt he holds. In some combination of cash, new debt, and ownership of the company going forward. A distressed debt investor tries to figure out A, what the bankrupt company is worth, or will be worth at the time it emerges from bankruptcy, B, how that value will be divided among the company's creditors and other claimants, and C, how long this process will take. With correct answers to those questions, he can determine what the annual return will be on a piece of the company's debt if purchased at a given price. Getting our start in distressed debt investing in 1988 was extremely advantageous, as there were few competitors, and the field was little known and little understood. Two conditions that can help make for superior returns possible in any field. As a result, our funds have been able to earn a high average return over the 29 years since. But as with many things, the average is of only limited significance. The funds we formed at less than great times generally have yielded good returns, but the results on funds formed at the right times have been superlative. In other words, the opportunities for top returns in distressed debt come and go. Given the subject matter of this book, what I'll review here is what it is that makes the opportunities rise and fall. Unsurprisingly, the answer lies in the fluctuations in the distressed debt cycle. What, in turn, causes those fluctuations? The opportunities to profit in distressed debt are highly cyclical and determined by developments in other cycles. Thus, they are illustrative of the workings of cycles and ripe for discussion here. In the beginning, in 1988, 1989, and early 1990, our funds benefited from the often ignored benefits of distressed debt investing, and our returns were good. But in the latter half of 1990, the market for sub-investment-grade debt collapsed in the first of the three major crises Bruce and I have worked through together. In addition to creating the low purchase prices that made our 1990 funds above-average gainers, this episode was highly educational, as it gave us our first glimpse of the process through which superior opportunities arise in distressed debt. The first of the two essential ingredients in their creation consists of the unwise extension of credit. Given the discussion in the last chapter, you should have an understanding of what I have in mind and how this develops. I'll explain through the example of high-yield bonds. At the start, appropriately risk-averse investors apply stringent credit standards to the issuance of high-yield bonds. The same healthy economic environment that facilitates bond issuance makes it easy for companies to service their existing debt, meaning defaults are scarce. Thus, high-yield bonds, with their generous interest coupons and little damage from defaults, provide solid realized returns. Those returns convince investors that high-yield bond investing is safe, attracting increased capital to the market. Increased capital for investment translates into increased demand for bonds. Since Wall Street never allows demand to go unmet, this results in increased bond issuance. The same condition that allows larger amounts of bonds to be issued, strong investor demand, invariably also allows bonds of lesser creditworthiness to be issued. Few lenders and bond buyers are imprudent enough to advance money that won't be repaid if conditions remain as they are, And in sober times, they insist on a margin of safety sufficient to ensure, as I said earlier, that interest and principal will be paid, even if conditions for the debtor deteriorate. But when the credit market heats up, when the race to the bottom causes avid lenders to finance less deserving borrowers and accept weaker debt structures, bonds are issued that lack that margin of safety and won't be able to be serviced if things get a little worse. This is the unwise extension of credit. This process, as noted earlier, stacks the logs in the fireplace for the next bonfire. But that's only the first half of the process. Even after the fuel for a bonfire has been assembled, there won't be a conflagration until the second ingredient arrives, an igniter. It usually comes in the form of a recession, which causes corporate profits to decline. This is often accompanied by a credit crunch, a slamming shut of the credit window, such that existing debt can't be refinanced and goes into default instead. And often conditions are exacerbated by exogenous events that sap confidence and damage the economy and the financial markets. In 1990, these consisted of the Gulf War, which was set off by the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, the bankruptcy of many of the prominent, highly levered buyouts of the 1980s, and the imprisonment of Michael Milken, the principal investment banker behind high-yield bonds, and the collapse of Drexel Burnham, Milken's employer and the investment bank most closely associated with high-yield bonds. With Drexel and Milken gone from the scene, the remedial exchanges that had helped weakened companies avoid default were hard to effect. When the igniter arrives, bonds that shouldn't have been issued, and perhaps even some that should have, begin to fail. A slower economy makes it harder for companies to service their debt. With the credit market closed, refinancing can't be accomplished, meaning defaults rise. Rising defaults damage investor psychology. Investors who were risk-tolerant when things were going well now become risk-averse. Advancing capital to financially distressed companies, which seemed like a good idea just a short time earlier, now goes out of favor. Potential debt buyers back away, refusing to catch a falling knife, and saying they'll wait until the uncertainty has been resolved. Capital that is mobile flees from the market. Buyers become scarce and sellers predominate. Selling of bonds increases. Bond prices cascade downward. Funds that receive withdrawals become forced sellers, and eventually, bonds are available for sale at any price. These are the conditions that give rise to the ability to effect bargain purchases of distressed debt, and thus, to opportunities for elevated returns. Of course, the cycle doesn't go in just one direction. Eventually, the economy begins to recover, and the credit market reopens. These two developments cause the default rate on high-yield bonds to recede. The combination of an improving economy and a declining default rate causes selling to abate. Thus, the downward pressure on bond prices eases, and some buying begins. Prices rise rather than fall, and balance sheet restructurings restore companies to viability, remove stumbling blocks, and unlock value. When gains on bond purchases made at the bottom begin to be noticed, additional capital is attracted to the market. The combination of better results and increased capital causes the demand for bonds to grow. And with that, we've gone full cycle. We're back to the beginning. A while back, I put together a concise synopsis of the way the cycle in bond issuance underlays the rise and fall of the distressed debt cycle. Here it is. Risk-averse investors limit quantities issued and demand high quality. High-quality issuance leads to low default rates. Low default rates cause investors to become complacent and risk-tolerant. Risk tolerance opens investors to increased issuance and lower quality. Lower quality issuance eventually is tested by economic difficulty and gives rise to increased defaults. Increased defaults have a chilling effect, making investors risk-averse once more. And so it resumes. This is a cycle I've seen in action repeatedly. My 29 years of experience in distressed debt tells me its themes definitely do rhyme. and the preceding description of the cycle gives me an excellent opportunity to make my point that each event in a cycle causes the one that follows. In fact, I designed this description specifically to achieve that goal. Take a look at the progression just described. You'll see that the final words of each line are the same as the first words of the line that follows. This is a true chain reaction, and one I expect to continue in the future. As you can see, the rise and fall of opportunities in the market for distressed debt stems from the interaction of other cycles in the economy, investor psychology, risk attitudes, and the credit market. The economic cycle influences investor psychology, company profitability, and the incidence of default. The cycle in psychology contributes to fluctuations in credit market conditions and the desire of investors to lend, buy, and sell. The cycle in attitudes toward risk facilitates the issuance of weak bonds at the top and denies capital for refinancing at the bottom. The credit cycle has a profound effect on the availability of refinancing and the degree to which would-be debt issuers are subjected to stringent credit standards. Hopefully, it's clear that multiple underlying cycles have effects on the distressed debt market that are far from discrete and isolated. As I wrote earlier, each of these cycles rises and falls. Each causes the others to rise and fall, and each is affected by the rise and fall of others. But the result of all of this is a dramatic cycle in distressed debt opportunities, and one that is subject to explanation. Chapter 11. The Real Estate Cycle. Much of investing is subject to gross generalizations and sweeping statements, usually stressing the positives because of humans' tendency toward greed and wishful thinking, and for some reason this seems particularly true in real estate. Over the course of my career, I've heard investment in real estate rationalized by easily digested statements like, "They're not making any more," in connection with land, "You can always live in it," in connection with houses, and "It's a hedge against inflation," in connection with properties of all types. What people eventually learn is that regardless of the merit behind these statements, they won't protect an investment that was made at too high a price. The cycle in real estate has a lot in common with other cycles, such as the one that controls the provision of capital or credit. Positive events and increased profitability lead to greater enthusiasm and optimism. Improved psychology encourages increased activity. That includes doing more of something, doing it on the basis of rosier assumptions, paying higher prices to do it, and or lowering the standards that have to be met if one is to do it. All of these things tend to entail the assumption of greater risk. The combination of positive psychology and the increase in activity causes asset prices to rise, which encourages still more activity, further price increases, and greater risk-bearing. Inevitably, this virtuous circle takes on the appearance of being unstoppable, and this appearance causes asset prices and the level of activity to go too far to be sustained. But when the news eventually turns less positive, and the environment becomes less hospitable, the levels of psychology, activity, and risk-bearing prove to have been excessive, and the same goes for asset prices. The resulting price correction causes psychology to become less positive, which causes disinvestment, which puts further downward pressure on prices, and so forth. These are all elements that most financial cycles have in common, and that includes the cycle in real estate. But the real estate cycle incorporates another ingredient that the others generally don't share: the long lead times required for real estate development to take place. In the credit market, for instance, good news and rosy psychology will lead to increased lending as soon as investment bankers can line up prospective borrowers and print prospectuses. Thus, lenders' increased ardor translates almost instantaneously into increased demand for securities, lower demanded yields, lower lending standards, and increased levels of lending and security issuance. But in the market for physical real estate, the world of so-called bricks and mortar, there can be significant delays. Before a new building can come to market, adding to the supply of space, and thus putting downward pressure on prices for space, if demand does not increase apace, economic feasibility studies have to be performed. A site has to be found and purchased. The building has to be designed. Environmental impact studies have to be performed. Permission to build has to be secured from authorities, and sometimes zoning modifications. Financing has to be obtained, and construction has to be completed. This process can run to several years, and in the case of a major project, it can exceed a decade. But market conditions can change very significantly in the interim. I'll use a description of the cycle in real estate development from Ditto, January 2013, to illustrate. As I said there, it's usually clear, simple, and regularly recurring. Bad times cause both the level of building activity to be low and the availability of capital for building to be constrained. In a while, the times become less bad and eventually even good. Better economic times cause the demand for premises to rise. With few buildings having been started during the soft period and now coming on stream, this additional demand for space causes the supply-demand picture to tighten, and thus rents and sale prices to rise. This improves the economics of real estate ownership, reawakening developers' eagerness to build. The better times and improved economics also make providers of capital more optimistic. Their improved state of mind causes financing to become more readily available. Cheaper, easier financing raises the pro forma returns on potential projects, adding to their attractiveness and increasing developers' desire to pursue them. Higher projected returns, more optimistic developers, and more generous providers of capital combine for a ramp-up in building starts. The first completed projects encounter strong pent-up demand. They lease up or sell out quickly, giving their developers good returns. Those good returns, plus each day's increasingly positive headlines, cause still more buildings to be planned, financed, and green-lighted. Cranes fill the sky, and additional cranes are ordered from the factory, but that's a different cycle. It takes years for the buildings started later to reach completion. In the interim, the first ones to open eat into the unmet demand. The period between the start of planning and the opening of a building is often long enough for the economy to transition from boom to bust. Projects started in good times often open in bad times, meaning their space adds to vacancies, putting downward pressure on rents and sale prices. Unfilled space hangs over the market. Bad times cause the level of building activity to be low and the availability of capital for building to be constrained. Note that, as in the case of many of the other cycles discussed here, each step leads to the next. In particular, the step at the bottom of the list is actually the one that kicks off the next iteration. This is a good example of the way in which cycles are self-perpetuating. In lending, since the time lags inherent in the process are brief, the economic and business conditions in force at the time that the will to lend arises and the loan is conceived generally, are still in force when the loan is funded. And if conditions change materially in the relatively brief interim, the lender may be able to pull his commitment under a material adverse change provision in the contract. Thus, there's relatively little risk in general lending resulting from the gap between idea and action. But given the many years that can pass between a building's conception and its opening, conditions can change enormously, as just described. This adds an element to real estate development that makes it potentially risky. Developers hope this risk will be offset by the fact that they can utilize extensive external financing, and thus they risk relatively little of their own money and are able to lever up the return on it to a great degree. When I moved to Los Angeles in 1980, steel skeletons stood along the Wilshire Corridor in Westwood, where gleaming condominium buildings had been imagined. The developers who had initiated these projects in the 1970s boom were caught out. The positive conditions that had supported the initiation of those projects had turned negative, as the economy turned down, and the supply created by quicker builders sopped up what demand there was. Some of those rusting skeletons remained uncompleted for years. The developer who had dreamed of a high return on a project's $100 million total cost, instead, lost his $5 million or $10 million of equity, and the banks lost a good part of the construction loans they had extended for those projects. That illustrates the downside of the real estate cycle and the effect of the extensive time lags. But investors who bought those halted projects, often from lenders that had repossessed them and completed them, often benefited from the ability to buy them for less than the developers had invested in land, planning, and titling and construction of the framework, the reduced cost to complete them at lower prices for labor and materials in a non-boom environment, the shorter period remaining between the onset of their involvement and the completion of the building, and the possibility that, just as they had been approved in good times and run into bad times, stalled projects purchased in bad times might come onto the market in good times. The long lead time in real estate development gave rise to this possibility, and my team participated in it. It illustrates the impact of cycles on profit potential. Initiating projects in boom times can be a source of risk. Buying them in weak times can be very profitable. It all depends on what you do and when you do it. Or, as they say in golf, every putt makes someone happy. There's another aspect of cycles that can be seen clearly in the real estate arena, although it affects cycles in many other areas as well, and that's the fact that people's decisions often fail to take into account what others are doing. Here's an example. When prosperity is rolling along and wealth and good feelings are rising, there generally will be increases in the demand for homes, resulting in increases in the price of homes, and increases in the availability of mortgage financing to home buyers. Often this causes a housing shortage to develop, as demand for homes increases relative to supply, which adjusts slowly. High home prices combined with eager lenders' financing of home builders to encourage the construction of new homes to meet the demand. A home builder might conclude there is unmet demand for 100 homes in his town. Out of an abundance of caution, and because of the limits on his scale and his access to funds, he decides to build just 20 new homes. So far, so good. But what if 10 home builders all make the same decision? In that case, 200 homes will be built. First, more homes will be built than there's demand for. And second, by the time those homes come on the market, the economy may have cooled. People may not feel as prosperous, and thus demand for homes might be sharply lower. In that case, the 200 new homes may encounter a dearth of demand, meaning they'll go unsold or sell for prices far below those on which the developers had based their decision to build. Now conditions have reversed. The economy is slow. Access to financing dries up, making it hard for would-be home buyers to obtain mortgages. And there's a sizable inventory of unsold homes. Clearly, the smart thing is for the builders to stop building. So, they all do so at the same time. Meaning, the next time the economy improves, there may not be enough homes to meet the increase in demand. And so forth. This is a straightforward description of one aspect of a cycle at work. And it isn't hypothetical. At the 2012 Oak Tree Conference, my partner, Raj Shuri, showed one of the most compelling graphs I've ever seen. The graph presents the record of annual housing starts in the U.S. from 1940 through 2010. The reason it made such an impression on me is that whereas it showed that 2010 housing starts were at the lowest level since wartime, 1945, and just equal to 1940's slightly less depressed level, that observation tells only part of the story. It fails to take into account the growth since the 40s in the U.S. population, the source from which long-run increases in demand for housing arise. Thus, While the number of starts in 2010 was the same as in 1940, the ratio of starts to population, arguably a far more meaningful figure, was only half the highly depressed 1940 level. The explanation is that practically no one had resumed building homes following the subprime mortgage crisis, housing bust, and global financial crisis of 2007 to 08. The key inference to draw from this observation was that the supply of new homes in the years immediately following clearly would be insufficient to meet a pickup in demand for homes. Of course, conventional wisdom at the time held that there could never be a pickup in demand for homes. Instead, most people were convinced that the American dream of home ownership was over. Demand for homes would remain depressed forever, and thus the overhang of unsold homes would be absorbed only very slowly. They cited the trend among young people, having been burnt by the collapse of the housing and mortgage bubbles, to rent rather than buy. And as usual, they extrapolated it rather than question its durability. As in so many of the examples in this book, for most people, psychology-driven extrapolation took the place of an understanding of and belief in cyclicality. It was clear to me and my Oak Tree colleagues from the graph and from our knowledge of the data behind it that because the greatest economic crash in almost 80 years had halted additions to the housing supply, home prices could recover strongly if there was any material increase in demand. And rejecting conventional wisdom, we were convinced that housing demand would prove cyclical as usual, and thus would pick up sometime in the intermediate term future. This conclusion, supported by other data and analysis, contributed to our decision to invest heavily in non-performing home mortgages and non-performing bank loans secured by land for residential construction, and to purchase North America's largest private home building company. These investments worked out quite well. It's interesting in this context to note what the Wall Street Journal said in a May 12, 2017 article headlined, "Generation of Renters Now Buying." In all, first-time home buyers have accounted for 42% of buyers this year, up from 38% in 2015 and 31% at the lowest point during the recent housing cycle in 2011. So much for extrapolating widespread abandonment of home ownership. This is an example of a case where awareness of the nature of cycles and our position in the current one permitted a profitable inference. And it is a case where a cycle standing at an extreme, this time housing starts at a deep trough, sent a signal calling for a highly profitable action. The proper course seems clear now, when we look back on the evidence. The reasons behind successful decisions invariably are obvious in hindsight. But in this case, dispassionate analysis of cyclical data permitted the right conclusion to be reached in real time, which is when it counts. While I'm on the subject of cycles in real estate, I want to touch, for the first time but not the last, on the way people occasionally conclude that some financial phenomenon has ceased being cyclical. And to that end, I'll discuss one of the greatest cases. When things go well, people tend to think the good times will roll on forever. In fact, not much time has to have elapsed since the last correction before cyclical history is overlooked in its entirety. Thus, it's appropriate to again cite John Kenneth Galbraith's observation regarding attitudes toward history. There can be few fields of human endeavor in which history counts for so little as in the world of finance. Past experience, to the extent that it is part of memory at all, is dismissed as the primitive refuge of those who do not have the insight to appreciate the incredible wonders of the present. Much of investing is subject to gross generalizations and sweeping statements, usually stressing the positives, because of humans' tendency toward greed and wishful thinking. And for some reason, this seems particularly true in real estate. Over the course of my career, I've heard investment in real estate rationalized by easily digested statements like, "They're not making any more," in connection with land. "You can always live in it," in connection with houses, and it's a hedge against inflation, in connection with properties of all types. What people eventually learn is that regardless of the merit behind these statements, they won't protect an investment that was made at too high a price. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, as I mentioned earlier, a number of elected officials decided that as a step toward benefiting society and increasing access to the American dream, it would be swell if more people owned homes. As a result, government-sponsored mortgage lenders got the message that home financing should be made more easily available, and they complied. The combination of this message, the resulting increase in mortgage availability, and the sharp decline in interest rates that was taking place at the time had a powerful stimulative effect on potential home buyers. The flow of money for mortgages was strongly encouraged by another real estate platitude: mortgage lending is safe. This was based on a conviction that a nationwide wave of mortgage defaults couldn't happen. The combination of strong economic growth, generally moderate economic fluctuations, and prudent mortgage lending practices had prevented the occurrence of such a wave in the period since the Great Depression, long enough for the last such episode to be forgotten, as Galbraith says. But that didn't mean lenders were incapable of lapsing into lending practices so generous and imprudent that a powerful recession could bring on such a wave of defaults. In the early years of the 21st century, the combination of strong demand for homes and plentiful mortgage money, abetted by optimistic media coverage, caused home prices to rise strongly. Thus, we started to hear yet another sweeping generalization concerning real estate: home prices always go up. See the section that follows. I hope by now you've caught on to the fact that the merits of the asset in question matter only so much, and certainly they can't be strong enough to always carry the day. Human emotion inevitably causes the prices of assets, even worthwhile assets, to be transported to levels that are extreme and unsustainable, either vertiginous highs or overly pessimistic lows. In short, conscientious belief in the inevitability of cycles, like I'm urging, means that a number of words and phrases must be excluded from the intelligent investor's vocabulary. These include never, always, forever, can't, won't, will, and has to. In the years leading up to the subprime mortgage crisis of 2007 and global financial crisis of 2007-08, a great deal of bullish behavior, which was later shown to have been reckless, was underlaid by the belief that homes could be depended on to appreciate steadily and not prove cyclical. As part of, or contributing to, the bullish trend, some researchers rendered supportive statements and optimistic projections. According to a New York Times Magazine article from March 5, 2006, titled "This Very, Very Old House," a vice president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York had concluded that the sharp rise in home prices is in line with economic conditions, not a skewed vision of reality. It even quoted him as saying, "We sometimes wonder why home prices haven't increased much more, given the tremendous increase in the size of mortgage the average family can finance." The article also mentioned like-minded experts from Columbia University and the Wharton School, who focus on what they call superstar cities, places so desirable that they not only are not headed for a correction, but they also can sustain ever-increasing prices compared with less sought-after cities. Of course, willingness to employ terms like ever-increasing should serve as an absolute red flag for the alert investor. But there was a lot to question regarding the reasonableness of these conclusions: the brevity of the data on home prices, the fact that statements made about the trend in the price of the average home sold in a given year don't necessarily say anything about the price performance of a given home or of all homes standing. For example, there is no adjustment for physical changes in the average house over time, or in the mix of homes sold that year, relative to all homes, and, likewise, there is no adjustment for the fact that neighborhoods and whole cities go in and out of favor over time, affecting the value of homes. For this reason, statements about homes in a given city or neighborhood wouldn't necessarily be applicable to homes in general. Thus, I found it very interesting when this very, very old house was published in 2006. It reported on a study that solved many of these methodological problems by following the price of a single house in Amsterdam, one that Pieter Frans built in 1625. It had stood since then, virtually unaltered, and had changed hands 6 times, but its location in the Heringgracht Canal neighborhood had remained Amsterdam's most desirable throughout. Thus, the article provided insight not as to whether the price of the average home had risen, but how the price of a particular home had performed. In contrast to the long-term optimists on housing quoted earlier, Yale's Robert Schiller said of the Franz House and its neighbors, "Looking at the Heringgracht data is very instructive, because you can see 50-year intervals of growth, then it turns around. That's more realistic than the superstar cities argument." The author of the study, Pete Eichholz, was described as being skeptical of those who claim that property values can continue to increase ad infinitum. He considered the economic arguments for it being different this time, but said, "You can see similarly rosy assessments made over and over, which are then quashed by circumstances." Amen. Here's more from the Times article. "There is a myth which says that real estate values go up significantly over time," Eichholz said, "but the data ended up challenging that myth. That is to say, where everyone from your wise old uncle to the broker who sold you your house holds it as gospel that real estate is one of the best long-term investments, this longest of long-term indices suggests that, on the contrary, it sort of stinks. Between 1628 and 1973, the period of Eichholz's original study, real property values on the Heringgracht, adjusted for inflation, went up a mere 0.2% per year, worse than the stingiest bank savings account. As Schiller wrote in his analysis of the Heringgracht Index, real home prices did roughly double, but took nearly 350 years to do so. It's only in recent years, Schiller says, that huge increases in real estate prices have become the norm, and that people have come to expect them. If this description of the past few years, in which prices just went up amazingly, typifies the brave new world we live in, putting it into the perspective of time, rise, fall, rise, fall, leads us back to what may be the oldest history lesson of all. It tends to repeat. Emphasis added. The long-term data on home prices is valuable, but the most important lesson is that, in times of rising asset prices, people turn bullish, and commentators provide authoritative support. That's only natural. In fact, rationalization for price appreciation that has taken place, and prediction of still more to come, invariably occurs at highs, not lows. For real help, I'd look to commentators who issue sober statements in bullish times, or who argue against negativity when markets are down. The real estate industry is subject to cyclical ups and downs like all others, but real estate cycles can be amplified by special factors. The time lags between conception and readiness for sale, the extremely high financial leverage that is typical, and the fact that the supply is generally too inflexible to be adjusted as demand fluctuates. That is, a manufacturer can eliminate a factory shift, lay off workers, or reduce production if demand for his product falters. But a landlord, hotelier, or real estate developer has a much harder time reducing the premises he has on offer if demand falls short. The cycle in real estate illustrates and exemplifies the ways in which cyclical factors lead to and cause each other, as well as the tendency of cycles to go to extremes. It's not for nothing that they often say cynically, In tougher times, when optimistic generalizations can no longer be summoned forth, that only the third owner makes money, not the developer who conceived and initiated the project, and not the banker who loaned the money for its construction, and then repossessed the project from the developer in the down cycle, but rather the investor who bought the property from the bank amid distress and then rode the upcycle. Of course, this is an exaggeration, like all generalizations, but it does serve as a reminder of the relevance of cyclicality to the real estate market, and especially of the way cyclicality can function in the less good times. Chapter 12. Putting it all together. The market cycle. The first time an inexperienced investor lives through an upward market cycle, the beginnings of the progression may seem logical, as the positives compound in a bull market, or bubble. The fact that so much good news and good feeling can end in losses can come as a surprise. It is inescapable that it will seem so to the uninitiated, of course, because if the progressions weren't permitted to go on to extremes on the basis of errors in judgment, markets wouldn't reach bull market tops to collapse from, or bear market bottoms to recover from. Our job as investors is simple: to deal with the prices of assets, assessing where they stand today, and making judgments regarding how they will change in the future. Prices are affected primarily by developments in two areas: fundamentals and psychology. Fundamentals, which I've been calling events, can largely be reduced to earnings, cash flow, and the outlook for the two. They are affected by many things, including trends in the economy, profitability, and the availability of capital. And psychology, how investors feel about fundamentals and value them, is likewise affected by many things, particularly investors' level of optimism and attitude toward risk. There are cycles in the elements mentioned above, and several aspects to each cycle. The themes behind the cycle's behavior, and the ways in which they interact and combine, have a repeating, understandable pattern, as we have discussed at length. They all come together, and they combine with idiosyncratic and random influences to cause the behavior of the securities market. It's my goal in this chapter to give you a feel for the cyclical ups and downs of the market. Not for the fact that it rises and falls, or how it has done so in the past, or what these movements were in reaction to, but rather the forces, and specifically, the non-fundamental, non-economic forces that cause it to go up and down, often in manic fashion. If the market were a disciplined calculator of value based exclusively on company fundamentals, the price of a security wouldn't fluctuate much more than the issuer's current earnings and the outlook for earnings in the future. In fact, the price generally should fluctuate less than earnings, since quarter-to-quarter changes in earnings often even out in the long run, and besides, don't necessarily reflect actual changes in the company's long-term potential. And yet, security prices generally fluctuate much more than earnings. The reasons, of course, are largely psychological, emotional, and non-fundamental. Thus, price changes exaggerate and overstate fundamental changes. Here's the shorthand version as to why. Events in the economy and in corporate profits turn increasingly positive. Positive events feed investor psychology. Emotion, so-called animal spirits, and investors' tolerance for risk all rise with those positive events, or sometimes despite negative ones. Rising psychology causes investors to be less demanding in terms of risk protection and prospective return. The combination of positive events, strengthening psychology, and the lowering of investors' return requirements causes asset prices to rise. Eventually, however, the process goes into reverse. Events fail to live up to expectations, perhaps because the environment that produces them becomes less hospitable, or perhaps because expectations were unrealistically high. Investors eventually prove that psychology can't remain positive forever. Cooler heads conclude that prices have reached levels that are unjustified, or psychology may soften for any of a million possible reasons, or for no apparent reason. Prices fall when events are less positive, or come to be viewed less positively. Sometimes it happens simply because prices have reached levels that are unsustainable, or because of negative developments in the environment. Having turned downward, asset prices continue to decline until they fall so low that the stage is set for their recovery. It's important to understand the way fundamentals and psychology interact, as described above. But it's essential that I repeat something about this process. While the description above is of one that is orderly and sequential, the process is nowhere near as neat as this description may make it seem. The sequence in which these things occur is subject to change, as is the very direction of causality. Sometimes events cause psychology to strengthen, and sometimes improving psychology has a positive impact on events. For example, bolstering the economy and corporate profits. And while it's obvious that improved investor psychology makes asset prices rise, it's just as obvious that rising prices make investors feel wealthier, smarter, and more optimistic. So, in other words, these relationships can work in both directions, and even do so simultaneously. And each can cause the other. The speed at which things play out is highly variable from cycle to cycle, and over the course of a given cycle. And lastly, cycles don't necessarily progress smoothly. Rather, they can be marked by dips, recoveries, and feints along the way. It's for reasons like these that investing can't be described as scientific and can't be depended on to work the same every time. I keep coming back to Mark Twain's observation that history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. The reasons and results are never the same as in the past, but they're usually reminiscent of developments we've seen before. Regardless of the imprecision of the process, it's clear that past events and expected future events combine with psychology to determine asset prices. Events and psychology also influence the availability of credit, and the availability of credit greatly affects asset prices, just as it feeds back to influence events and psychology. In sum, these things all come together to create the market cycle. We hear about it every day, most prominently in connection with the ups and downs of the stock market, but also with regard to markets for things like bonds, gold, and currencies. This is where many cycles intersect, and it's the subject of this chapter. Financial theory portrays investors as economic men, objective, rational optimizers. Thus, it suggests that the market they collectively form is what author and investor, and Warren Buffett's teacher, Ben Graham, called a weighing machine, a disciplined assessor of the value of assets. In stark contrast, however, the truth is that financial facts and figures are only a starting point for market behavior. Investor rationality is the exception, not the rule, and the market spends little of its time calmly weighing financial data and setting prices free of emotionality. Investment fundamentals are rather straightforward. Past events have already taken place and been recorded, and many people have the quantitative skills required to analyze them. Current performance is captured in financial statements, which sometimes present an accurate picture and sometimes require skillful adjustment. And future events are unknown to everyone, although some investors are better able than others to foresee them. Fundamentals aren't the most variable part of investing, or the part that intrigues me most. And anyway, I can't write a book telling you how to know more than others about future events. Doing a superior job of that requires elements of foresight, intuition, and second-level thinking that I doubt can be reduced to paper or taught. The part of investing that fascinates me, that I find myself thinking of most, and where my Oak Tree colleagues and I have made some of our greatest contributions to our clients' welfare, regards the ways in which investors deviate from the assumption of rationality and the contribution of those ways to the oscillation of cycles. A large number of elements play parts in this aspect of investment decision-making, interfering with the process of arriving at purely economic decisions. They may come under the headings of human nature, psychology, or emotion. The distinction isn't straightforward or important for our purposes here, and they absolutely are capable of dominating investor behavior and thus markets. Some, but not all, vary cyclically, and they all can affect or exacerbate cycles. Here are the most important influences. The way investors fluctuate rather than hold firmly to rational thinking and the resulting rational decisions. The tendency of investors to hold distorted views of what's going on, engaging in selective perception and skewed interpretation. Quirks, like confirmation bias, which makes people accept evidence that confirms their thesis and reject that which doesn't. And the tendency toward non-linear utility, which causes most people to value a dollar lost more highly than a dollar made, or a dollar of potential profit foregone. The gullibility that makes investors swallow tall tales of profit potential in good times, and the excessive skepticism that makes them reject all possibility of gains in bad times. The fluctuating nature of investors' risk tolerance and risk aversion, and thus of their demands for compensatory risk premiums. The herd behavior that results from pressure to fall into line with what others are doing, and as a result, the difficulty of holding non-conformist positions. The extreme discomfort that comes from watching others make money doing something you've rejected. Thus, the tendency of investors who have resisted an asset bubble to ultimately succumb to the pressure, throw in the towel, and buy, even though, no, because, the asset that is the subject of the bubble has appreciated substantially. The corresponding tendency to give up on investments that are unpopular and unsuccessful, no matter how intellectually sound, and finally, the fact that investing is all about money, which introduces powerful elements, such as greed for more, envy of the money others are making, and fear of loss. Bulls and bears. Investors have been characterized for at least 100 years as either bulls, optimists who think stocks will rise and behave aggressively as a result, or bears, pessimists who think they'll fall and who thus behave defensively. Consequently, people apply the label of bull market to a market that has risen, is rising, or will rise, it's quite imprecise, and bear market to the opposite. About 45 years ago, in the early 1970s, I received one of the greatest gifts I was ever given, when an older and wiser investor introduced me to the three stages of a bull market. The first stage, when only a few unusually perceptive people believe things will get better. The second stage, when most investors realize that improvement is actually taking place. And the third stage, when everyone concludes things will get better forever. The arrival of this simple truth opened my eyes to the notion of investors' psychological extremes and the impact of those extremes on market cycles. Like many of the great quotations and adages, it captures disproportionate wisdom in a few simple words. It's all about the changeability of attitudes, the pattern they follow over the course of a cycle, and how they contribute to error. In the first stage, because the possibility of improvement is invisible to most investors, and thus unappreciated, security prices incorporate little or no optimism. Often the first stage occurs after prices have been pounded in a crash. And the same downtrend that decimated prices also has wiped out psychology, turning the members of the crowd against the market and causing them to swear off investing forever. In the last stage, on the other hand, events have gone well for so long and have been reflected so powerfully in asset prices, further lifting the mood of the market, that investors extrapolate improvement to infinity and bid up prices to reflect their optimism. Trees generally don't grow to the sky, but in this stage, investors act as if they will and pay up for the limitless potential they perceive. Few things are as costly as paying for potential that turns out to have been overrated. It follows from the above that someone who invests in the first stage, when almost no one can see a reason for optimism, buys assets at bargain prices from which substantial appreciation is possible. But someone who buys in the third stage invariably pays a high price for the market's excessive enthusiasm and loses money as a result.